Our Lady, Mother of the Church,
pray for us.
St. Michael the Archangel,
pray for us.
St. John Fisher and St. Thomas More,
pray for us.
St. Margaret, Queen of Scots,
pray for us.
All holy martyrs of England, Wales and Scotland,
pray for us.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Okay. This afternoon's talk is going to be given by Mr. John Deegan. John's the current parliamentary officer for the Bishops' Conference of Scotland. He's involved in all political liaison on what's become some socially diverse issues. John's going to talk about how he's come to be in his current position. Mr. John Deegan.
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me to your conference. It's a pleasure to be here and to participate. I quite often speak outside of Scotland, but I get a common request, and that is, John, could you repeat that in English? So if I start speaking, as the typical Scots do, very quickly, and some of you English can't keep up, just wave me down and I'll slow down again. But anyway, I was having a good look at your programme, and I noticed that it said that part of the work of the faith movement was to synthesise religion and science. And I thought it's a very laudable task, and one which is very difficult in our age. But it did remind me of a particular story. And it was the wee girl who, at that stage in her life, was starting to realise, well, the world was quite an amazing place, and I'm amazing being a human person. And she said to her dad, "Dad, where did I come from? Where did people come from?" And the dad said, "Well, many millions of years ago, there was a Big Bang, and then from the Big Bang, the Earth formed, then there were primitive organisms, and then those organisms..." He told a big story, and the girl was going, whoa, she was a bit confused by that, but she listened anyway. And that night, her mum was tucking her into bed and saying her prayers, and she said, "Mum, where did I come from?" So the mum says, "Well, many years ago, many, many years ago, God made Adam and Eve, and then Adam and Eve had children, and their children had children." She was in that, and she went, "Oh, Mum, I'm really, really confused." And she said, "Dad said we came from monkeys, and you're saying we come from Adam and Eve." And the mum says, "Dear, don't worry about it. Your dad's just telling you about his side of the family. I'm telling you about my side of the family." Anyway, we live in confusing times, and I live in a particularly... I've been, for the last 14 years, I've been working as a parliamentary officer for the Bishops' Conference of Scotland. And I've been asked to give a wee bit of a sort of biographical talk, which really threw me. I must say, I've spent so much time thinking about this, and I've not really got any notes to show for it, so I'm hoping I say something of interest. I'm going to try. I've got some notes there. Don't worry. If I go off too far off beam, I'll go back and make sure I'm saying something which I think is of interest, especially to your age group. I think we live at a fascinating time in history, and we all think our particular age is normal, our particular lives are normal, but we do live in a crucial time. I genuinely think we are living at the end of Christendom, Europe as it was Christendom. So we're living through a tumultuous time where changes are very rapid, and it's very hard to understand what's going on in our life. But we also live in a time, I suppose, with the best of things and with the worst of things. Great technological advancement, great capacity to do good, and yet massive capacity to do evil and to misuse the freedom that we have to the point of self-destruction. That's what we seem to be living through. Anyway, I'm going to try and say a wee bit about some of the issues I've been involved in, laced through a bit of my biographical things. I think my wife said I would be cheating if I didn't do what I was asked to do, so I will go back a bit. So I'm doing this job, which is a bit of a, for me, when I think back, how did I end up doing it? I tell some audiences that actually I ended up getting this job when someone said to me, "John, you need to get to Mass every day." And I had a job then. I thought, there's no way I could get to Mass every day. And he said, "Well, start praying for it." And within a couple of months, I had a different job and I could get to Mass every day. So sometimes you ask for things and you get an answer you don't expect. But anyway, my first job was as an engineer. I studied physics and I was involved in engineering. From that sort of background, there was certainly nothing in my mind that made me think I'd ever be working for the church or get involved in all of these issues, particularly as I go into what these issues have been. They'd never entered my head to even think about them, to be honest, and it's quite amazing. It has underlined for me that all of our lives really are a forum or a theatre or an opportunity that God presents to us to cooperate with him in creating the sort of person that is fit to be in heaven. And sometimes through my life I can see that clearly, or sometimes it's looking back on it at the time, and I very often go through times when I'm saying, God, give me a break, not another terrible thing that's happening. There's lots of that. And I think that's the struggle of life. And God will at times mould us gently, and other times he'll take a chisel out to us and mould us the way we need to be moulded. But I think it's all, you know, very often when you give a bit of cooperation, you see that your life takes a whole new different turn. And I remember John Paul II saying that. He was talking to young people, and I was a bit younger than I am now when I heard that. And it was just saying about, you know, give your life to Christ and you will be amazed at where it takes you. And I must say, any time I've done that in life, it has been surprising where you end up. But anyway, I was working in engineering, and I got put on a project to work in France. So I was very pleased for Father, I'm going to say the name long, Guillaume, is he still here? French priest. Father, sorry, I got your name wrong. But so I was pleased to get a blessing from a French priest. I spent a year in France, and that's where I met my wife. She wasn't French. So I'll practice my French later with you. So I was working then, and I met my wife. And I suppose an incident I can remember from then, which maybe will highlight to you how things have changed so radically. And it was one of the French guys, and he'd heard that I was engaged to be married. And he just assumed that me and my now wife, Angela, would be living together. And I said, no, once you get married, you move in together. And he was absolutely astounded. I remember being astounded that he was so astounded. He was absolutely shocked. I thought, that's weird. I mean, and I don't know if it's your particular town or your culture or your family, but it wouldn't even have dawned on me. And my mum would have killed me. So how much it has changed. What a challenge it is now where so few are marrying. And the example that so many people have today is, get married? You're nuts. Why on earth would you do that? Why would you commit yourself to that? So there has been a huge change in marriage culture. And I'll get on to talking about how I've been involved politically and within the church on that. But it is amazing to me to think back to my near innocence, I suppose, about how different culture was then. But certainly I saw that as a huge commitment, but something that it was for life, something that you put yourself into to give yourself to another person. And I suppose the root of the marginalisation of marriage is the fact that there has been, over the last few decades, a corruption of love, a corruption of the understanding of love. In fact, to such an extent that Pope Benedict XVI surprised us all when his first encyclical was Deus Caritas Est, and he tried to give an analysis of what love actually is. And he looked at the two in particular, I suppose C.S. Lewis has four loves, and there are other ways of looking at love. But the Pope in particular highlights eros, or erotic love, and he examines that. You know, because the challenge from Nietzsche, the postmodern philosophers, was that Christianity had poisoned love. Somehow we'd taken the fun out of it. That was the charge then. And the Pope looks at that, and he takes that seriously. And he gets to a point where he says that he talks about the different loves and how love is misused, but he says there is a particular form of love which is unique and special, and that is the love between a man and a woman. And that's because it's a particular love that helps us fulfill our human nature. And much of the understanding we have of love today, and even of marriage and relationships with other people, is a lot about what we can get from them, what we would like to enjoy from them. So there has been that corruption, and it's very easy to go along with it in a society which has become used to being an opportunity for us to fulfill or satisfy all of our appetites. It's very easy to inflame the sexual appetite. So we've seen a corruption of love. But it's a love, if eros or erotic love becomes something that's just about using the other person, what Pope Benedict goes on and says is that you're reducing it to a commodity. And if you're reducing love to a commodity, what you're doing is reducing, you're dehumanizing the other person that you're using for that commodity. And what he says is that we have to purify eros, purify that form of love which the different nature of man and woman reveals to us. And we purify it by a form of love that we call agape, a self-giving love. A love where I see that something is good and I think, you know, that's so good, I am willing to give myself for that. I'm willing to sacrifice myself for that. That is the extent to which we as a voice in society today can try and rescue this marginalisation of marriage, corruption of love, and the instrumentalisation of human beings that we're willing to use other people just for the pleasure that they can give us. So anyway, how did I go into that from me being married? But anyway, that's a challenge of our time. And it reveals also the great lie about human nature, about us achieving fulfillment as human beings by receiving things. What this understanding of love that Christianity gives, and I suppose it was given by the Vatican Fathers as well, and Gaudium et Spes, they spoke about the human person finding themselves, fulfilling their nature when they give of themselves. As a human person, we are designed that if we give of ourselves, forget ourselves, give ourselves to others, that is actually what completes and fulfills our nature. And it's a way in which we reflect the image of God. So in that relationship, we are showing, we are imaging what is happening in the Trinity. When God the Father really is pouring himself out, and from that pouring himself out is generating the Son, and then the love between the two is generating the third person. And that is what love, erotic love, points towards. This design in human nature that God made us, male and female, he made us, that is pointing towards the fact that we are able to cooperate in love in a way which is fruitful, and it leads to the creation, us to participate. I suppose creation, maybe the participation in the creation of a new person, a new human being that will exist forever. Now, when we see love between a man and a woman in that way, it gives us an insight into the fact that the church sees sexual relationships as something as special, something which is sacred, and in fact which is raised to a level of a sacrament in marriage. The world, I'm afraid, has lost sight of that. And by corrupting it, I'm afraid we're doing a lot of damage to our society. So that's the vision of marriage that I've seen through my life being corrupted. But anyway, if I move on to a wee bit more about myself. So in being married, it's a path, it's a vocation of giving yourself to another person. And it helps to make you a better person by doing that. By forgetting about yourself, knowing that there's someone else that you have to look out for. And your wife or your husband is usually pretty good at letting you know when you haven't done that. So you've got an opportunity to be involved in an institution which is designed in a particular way by God to fulfill you and for you to find happiness. But anyway, from that, I mentioned that that love is ordered to fruitfulness. I've been lucky enough that being married, so I got married in a long time ago now. I'm older. It goes back into the, it's lost in the mists of time now, how long ago it was I was married. But anyway, I think 1991 I was married. But since then, I was very lucky, and I've been able to have 7 children since then. So 7 children. 1 boy came first. It was so difficult for me, those pregnancies, especially labour. It really upsets my wife when I say that. But she would squeeze my hand really hard. So that time, I remember listening to an American philosopher. Some of you have maybe heard her. She's very entertaining, Janet Smith. And she points out that having a child instantly makes you a better person just by having a child. And well, she points out that suddenly you actually care about your neighbourhood, she calls it. You care about what's happening there. What's the crime level like? What's the schools like? Who's in charge of the police? You suddenly, instead of thinking about me, you're thinking about someone else. And then when you get that wee baby you're taking home, you think, wow, you are willing to give up of yourself. And practically speaking, you have to. To be honest, I think when Sean, my son was 9, he had 6 wee sisters. I pretty much had 10 years of no sleep. You know, and it was like, oh, you're kidding, the baby again. And you just didn't know. You had to do it. You just have to get on with the practicalities of bringing up your children. And it forces you to forget yourself. And again, so family life is an opportunity, again, that God is using for us to mould ourselves to be better persons. Anyway, so I've got the so I had the kids. By this time, I was doing a lot of pro-life work, so I think that really is how things started to change. And it was the typical thing that there was somebody I knew. My mum had a cousin who was involved in pro-life, and it's typical that things that you can never get folk to volunteer for anything. And he'd asked me to get involved in a pro-life group. I said, "Oh, well, okay," you know. So you go along. So I did that, and so I was doing that. I'd changed career by then as well. So I worked for Rolls Royce. I'd moved on from France and was working for Rolls Royce, and they were closing down the particular factory I was working in. So I went back to university and studied computing, and I ended up training as a systems analyst and then becoming a lecturer in systems analysis. So I was doing that, but anyway, I got a phone call and said, "Will you get involved in a pro-life group?" So yeah, okay. So I got involved in that, you know, you're feeding the kids and all that, and joining groups and then organising stuff in a parish. It was a disaster. No one would come to the meetings. It was that typically that thing. But then quite a while after that, I got a phone call from the same elderly cousin saying, "John, guess what?" This was coming up to 1997. "Guess what? There's this party that are going to stand in the election, the Pro-Life Alliance. Fantastic. They're going to raise the issue of abortion. Everyone will hear about it. There'll be an election broadcast. Isn't that brilliant?" And I was saying, "Oh, outstanding. Thank goodness someone's standing up and, you know, flying the flag and let everybody know that." And he says, "The only trouble is they're one person short." And I was like, oh. And my wife had just been saying to me that night, "John, you're doing too many things. You better not do anything else," because I was teaching a night class and various other things. So he just said, "They need one more person or they won't get the election broadcast." And I was like, "Oh, you're kidding." So anyway, by the end of the phone call, guess what? Yeah, I'd signed up and I was standing in the election, the general election 1997. So I was never a political anorak or like that sort of stuff, to be honest. I was not really. I saw the need for being involved in politics for the pursuit of justice, and I knew it was important. But really, when I had to do that, I thought, oh. And, you know, and when you get told, and when people sell you a thing, just remember this, is they always make it sound, you know, as easy as possible. "John, you're a paper candidate. Your name will be on a list. You'll never have to do anything." The next thing, I'd reporters from the East Kilbride News chapping the door, saying, "Well, here you're on the," and inviting me to a massive big debate. And then I had a column in the local newspaper. And before I knew it, I was out during the night putting posters up around all the lampposts in East Kilbride. It was a massive, huge effort. So anyway, I did that. But the thing is, I got involved with some fantastic people, but they actually thought I could win. And I was thinking, "Guys, you are absolutely insane. There's no, how could you win an anti-abortion party in the most Labour seat, I think, and one of the most Labour seats in Scotland?" So that was a real eye-opener for me, an eye-opener to the confusion as well, because the hostility I got was really amazing. Especially in my parish, I turned up at a parish church thing. "Hey guys, I'm standing as a candidate in the election," and oh my goodness, what a mistake that was. So a lot of parishioners were extremely hostile. That really surprised me, because I remember phoning into a radio program one time because someone had said, "Oh, Catholics are just as much for abortion as anyone else," and I thought, no way. So I phoned in saying, "How dare you say that? All Catholics are against abortion." Anyway, I found out differently. So anyway, the election came and went. I didn't win. So the next thing that happened, so I was totally known all over East Kilbride and at college as well. All the students suddenly knew that this was a new sort of pastime I had. And suddenly all the students were coming to me to ask me. They were all getting, I taught computing, as I said, systems analysis. But suddenly all the lecturers were sending the pupils to me or the students because they were doing their debates on abortion and those issues. So suddenly I was suddenly in demand in the college. And then that started to get me more involved in talking to the kids about faith issues as well. So it really was, just by sort of dipping my toe in the water, I suddenly found that I was just in that place that people were coming and asking, and they were demanding answers. And the more I was, so when people ask you answers, I always sort of did like debating. So I always liked to have the answer. And I thought, well, I need to look into that. So the more I looked into it, I started to see that everything the church taught answered all the questions. It was only the church that had a consistent view. So I started to read into that. I read into all this stuff on everything on euthanasia, on contraception, and all those issues. And I started to say, wow, the Catholic Church is the only one that has the right answer. So it helped strengthen my faith. It got me involved in that. But anyway, so jump on 6 months, and I got another phone call. And it was, John, guess what? An MP in Paisley has died. I went, oh, that's a shame. They're going to have a by-election, and you got the highest vote of all the pro-life candidates. We think you should stand in that by-election. And I was thinking, no, please. So I really tried everything to get out of that, and I'm afraid I didn't get out of it. And so suddenly, but this was much worse. I thought the general election was bad. This was a nightmare. So a couple of days into it, I was thinking, oh, I'll be a paper candidate. I won't go high profile. It pays me. I'm an East Kilbride. It won't be. And the next thing, the TV cameras that were at the door. And then STV phoned me up and said, oh, we have this thing. It's called Platform on Paisley, or Platform on whatever the by-election is. And it's going to be a televised debate with all the candidates. And I thought, oh, there's no way on it. I am not doing that. And I thought, how am I going to get out of this? And they said, oh, well, it's easy. They always say that. It's really easy. We'll send you a DVD of the last one. They'd had one in Perth just a few months before that. We'll send you that, and you'll see how easy it is. So they sent me that. It was a VHS tape in those days. So I put that in, press play, and when I saw it, I said to Angela, I can't go. Could you phone up and tell them I'm not in it? So anyway, by then, I couldn't escape. It's a usual thing. I just could not get out of it. So I went along. So that they phoned me to go for the first big debate, the televised thing. Most of them were just TV, wee snippets and TV interviews. But this was like a 1.5 hour program. And I was to, and it was a big audience like this. And I'd never spoken in front of an audience like, especially a hostile one. And so when I got there, they said, John, you're not allowed to bring anyone else. You need to turn up on your own. Everyone will be like that. So I turned up, tried to get a parking space in Glasgow, which is a nightmare for those who know what that is. I went into the studios, and there were all the candidates with teams of about 12 people round about them, rubbing their shoulders and all that, and getting them all ready. And I was on my own. And I was like, God, give me a break. And I remember sitting in the chair, and I thought, I have no idea what I'm going to say. I just don't know. And I think I had to give like a 3-minute introduction at the start of it. So anyway, I just thought that was a nightmare. But somehow, I said, God, you got me here. I've not wanted to do it. You better put words in my mouth than say the right thing. But anyway, it went not bad. And it went not bad enough that someone got in touch with me a while after that. So anyway, I didn't win, as you can imagine. So we didn't win the Paisley by-election. So the guy who did win it is Douglas Alexander. You know Douglas Alexander? And he was a wee timid guy at the time. Now he's big and famous and wealthy and all the things. All the things I'm not. So anyway, so as his star ascended, I went a different path. So anyway, I got a phone call one night from another guy saying, oh, Cardinal Winning saw you on something or other, and he thought you should maybe apply for a job with the Catholic Church as a parliamentary officer. I was like, no way. Me? John, who's not got a clue about anything, all these issues? So anyway, then that took a long, long time, and before I knew it, I got the job. It was a long There's too many side avenues in that story to tell you. But suddenly I found that I was the parliamentary officer for the Catholic Church. And if someone had said to me, John, what do you think of homosexuality at that time? I'd have shrugged my shoulders and said, well, live and let live, you know, stuff like that. I'd never have guessed of that. I'm 14 years. I'm an expert on homosexuality. If you want to ask me anything on it in the question time, try anyway. I'm sure I am. But I am astounded that has happened. And the understanding now that I gained of the secular world, what is happening with secularism, is really quite astounding. So anyway, that's in parallel. If I can just jump back. So this thing politically, and then at the same time, I'm trying to bring up my kids and thinking about the children. And you're starting to see that your kids are, you know, watching TV, going to clubs, you know, the soap operas, reading magazines. As they start to grow up, they're doing all of these things. And you start to realise that they're absorbing the values of the society around about them. And you start to realise the importance of the culture, the way we live, what our values are, what we think of things, just how we do things. And you start to see that has a huge impact on the formation of your children. And the church has always taught that responsible parenthood is not just about having children or being open to life and having children in marriage, but it's also about raising the children. So then you find as a parent you're having to take that seriously, and you're having to think, well, hold on a minute, what are the kids watching? And even then, to be honest, then maybe I was a bit uptight, and you see there was a thing on, and the kids were all, they dressed up in these suits and all whacking each other, doing kung fu. And, you know, if you watched that, Sean would be leaping about the living room, kicking things and practicing on his sisters and doing all of those things. So you start to see that the role models that children, and even ourselves, adults, the role models that we have in society greatly influence the sort of person that you start to become. And I remember hearing Alice van Hildebrand talk about the different role models or the different people that we look up to through different generations. And she pointed out that at one time in history, if you look back to the Middle Ages, and you said, who's the most impressive person? Who is it that you would like to be like? Or who's the most important? They would have said a saint. So at that time, they'd have been impressed by a saint. Catholics would have read the lives of the saints. But then from the time of the Enlightenment, when we started to recognise our understanding, or recognise that we could properly understand the world better, and scientific method came in, we started to realise that, wow, these scientists are really quite incredible. And we started to, instead of moving from a saint, we then started to admire a genius. So a genius would be the person. So suddenly, you know, even in my generation, you'd want to be Einstein or Watt or Edison or someone like that. But in our age, we've moved on. I suppose we call it modernity or post-modernity now. Now, and my daughter revealed this just recently. She came home. She said, oh, Dad, we have to talk about someone that impresses us, and we have to give a presentation in our English class on it. And so Catherine's 12. And I said, oh, fantastic. And I'm thinking, oh, I was thinking of St. Nicholas Owen, or, you know, St. Francis or St. Ignatius of today, or somebody like that. And she said, oh, I've got the person, Bruno Mars. And I was like, oh, Bruno Mars? So anyway, I had no idea who Bruno Mars was either. You're a young guy. I can see the puzzled older folk like myself. I was going, Bruno Mars? I thought it was Mars Bars. I was thinking, what? What on earth is Bruno Mars? So I said, you are not going in. So I gave her a list of folks. She went. I couldn't get her to do a saint quite, you know, but I got her to do Martin Luther King. At least he did, you know. So, but the English teacher at the parents' night said, oh, it was amazing. Catherine was the only person that didn't choose a pop star. But anyway, the point I'm getting at, the people we admire now are celebrities. So we've moved from that. We've moved from saint to geniuses to celebrities. And the more we're looking at these celebrities, we're looking at new role models. And the role models are helping form our culture. And this is why this generation has been subject to an immense level of social conditioning. Because what you're able to do with role models now, in television, and even in magazines or books or whatever, what you're able to do with a role model is you're able, if you do it in television or in film, you're able to plan out the consequences. And it's a fictitious person. So you can write whatever script you want for EastEnders and whatever film it is, and the person whose life is always sorted out, who always gives advice to all the married friends, if they are married, is the homosexual guy, the guy who's always judgmental and nasty, a bit of an oddball probably, is the Christian, typically a Catholic. So you could easily start to create these roles in the media. And that's the sort of world in which I was realising that our children were brought up in. So it made me, just in my approach to it, it made me put a bit of an emphasis on trying to make the children more acquainted with other role models. So I've really put an effort into trying to acquaint them with the saints, tell them saint stories, get them saints books, so that they know about some of the saints, because they're truly inspiring. I mean, I mentioned Nicholas Owen earlier, but I don't know if it gets folk excited nowadays, but I remember reading a biography of Nicholas Owen, and it got to the bit, you know, this was a guy, stunted growth, he'd been a bad accident when he was younger, he was badly lame, but he was a master craftsman, and he built all the priest holes. He was a lay Jesuit. He built all the priest holes that allowed the Jesuits to remain in England, mostly, at the time when Henry VIII was trying to destroy, and Queen Elizabeth were trying to destroy the church. And so it gets to the bit when they actually capture him, and they're so excited. We have caught Nicholas Owen. We're going to find every priest hole in England, and we're going to capture all these Jesuit priests, and we're going to eventually, finally, crush the Catholic faith. And they tortured them for days, and not a word comes from Nicholas Owen to betray any of those he'd collaborated with or to reveal any of those priest holes. So stories like that, or the story of Father John Gerard, who was one of the Jesuits at the time, and his life reads like a James Bond thriller. So it was just, you know, the only guy who's ever escaped from the Tower of London. And actually, Nicholas Owen was one of the guys who masterminded it. Stories like that, that we're just not familiar with, that young people just don't hear about anymore. And what I think is troubling for us now is that we don't seem to have... I speak to lots of young groups, and what I think, we've not been able to prepare them to pick out when they're being manipulated by the media. And I spotted a quote from Dorothy Sayers, actually, which I thought I would say to you. So she spotted this several decades ago. And she says, has it ever struck you as odd or unfortunate that today, when the proportion of literacy throughout Western Europe is higher than it has ever been, people should have become susceptible to the influence of advertisement and mass propaganda to an extent hitherto unheard of and unimagined? And she goes on to say, we fail lamentably on the whole in teaching them how to think. They learn everything except the art of learning. For we let our young men and women go out unarmed in a day when armour was never so necessary. By teaching them all to read, we have left them at the mercy of the printed word. By the invention of the film and radio, we have made certain that no aversion to reading shall secure them from the incessant battery of words, words, words. They do not know what the words mean. They do not know how to ward them off or to blunt their edge or fling them back. They are prey to the words in their emotions, instead of being masters of them in their intellects. And that gets to a point that there's a Scottish philosopher, Alistair MacIntyre, and he analyses our society today, and he says the problem of our age is that we've moved beyond reason. We now have what he calls emotivism. And this is typically what I find when I go to speak to young audiences. They are led by their emotions, and their emotions are so easily manipulated. They're so easily taken in by a soap opera character or a pop star or the lyrics to a pop song. And to the extent that you cannot reason with them about the realities, even when we're talking about marriage now, I think recently I was in a Catholic school and the pupils were saying that I should actually be in jail because I should not be allowed to teach hatred. And I was just saying to them that Catholics believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. But no amount of reason would work with them. Now, McIntyre's analysis, I'm sure from... I was a bit scared when I saw how learned the audience was this morning with those questions. I thought, I don't hope I don't get any difficult ones. But anyway, I'm sure you've all read McIntyre and got to his conclusion. But his conclusions really are is that we can recognise what's right and wrong because we can recognise virtue when we see it. Now, a wee example, I suppose, would be if I held up to you and said, well, you know, this is a watch. You know, typically you come over, if it didn't have a face on it, it was just a bracelet, you'd say, John, that's not a watch, it's a bracelet. Because you know that a watch, the thing about a watch is it tells the time. There's something about what it does that reveals to you what it is. And similarly, what McIntyre challenges is that it's by seeing the good. And I suppose this, I'm frightened to say anything in natural law because I know you experts are all out there. But, you know, from natural law, we see what leads to human flourishing. So when we see human flourishing, we can recognise it. And the church is remaining a witness to the lives and the way of living that leads to human flourishing. And I'm afraid that is under attack. In Spes Salve, Pope Benedict goes through really the trajectory of why we've ended up here. I suppose it's where Alistair McIntyre, I suppose, is picking up from. And it looks at how at the time of the Enlightenment, as we started to think that, oh, we can understand the world. We can sort out all the problems ourselves. We've mastered science. If we master science, we can master the world. We can save ourselves. And if we can save ourselves, who needs a saviour? Who needs religion? Who needs faith? We can do it on ourselves. We can make man the measure of all things. So what we did is we sort of separated reason and science from faith. And that's why it's so encouraging for me to read through your programme and think, well, these guys are synthesising it back together again. Because that's so much needed today. We've thought that we can marginalise faith and push it to the side. It's actually not even something that's it's not needed, but actually something that's antagonistic or a threat to reason. That's the stage we're at. So that's what we have moved on in such a virulent way to see that faith has to actually be stamped out because it's a threat to freedom. And that's because for many people, being a witness to the fact that we have to use our freedom to pursue good is a problem for them. Because remember, all of us have particular appetites and we can easily pursue our appetites and see that, the satisfaction of them, as the fulfillment of freedom. Use your freedom to pursue whatever suits you, whatever whim enters your head or fancy. And that's the challenge. That's the two different views. That's the cultural challenge which can arise in any generation, but in particular in our generation has become a huge... it's a global struggle now. It's a global struggle between Christianity and its vision of the human person and what, I suppose, is a new form of paganism. Archbishop Fisichella came to Scotland in 2008 and gave a talk on this. It was quite fascinating. And he says that we are living through a similar time to the collapse of the Roman Empire. So when you read the City of God and you read what Augustine's talking about then, he saw how the Roman Empire was collapsing. But at least at that time, Christianity was starting to flourish. It was starting to spread. The trouble is now we're going in decline. So as Christianity is dying, we do not know what will supersede this culture in which we're living. But anyway, how do I get back to where I was? So let me just jump back quickly because I don't think... I said I would talk for 45 minutes. So I think I've got a wee bit of time left. We started late. So my job in the parliamentary office, if I jump back to that, has been working through the symptoms of a massive cultural change. So for 14 years, to be honest, it has felt a bit like trying to fight against a tidal wave. It's one issue after another after another, which is being implemented by people who actually know that they have a blueprint that they're working to. As I said, this idea that religion is a threat to them, that is the driving force behind the whole secularist movement. Now, as I said, it's not just happening now, but we, in particular, for the last 40 years, there has been a blueprint. And the church's teaching on marriage nowadays has been made so inflammatory for people that anyone with same-sex attraction now sees us as hostile to them. And that's not the truth at all. The church has a vision about how you will find happiness and fulfillment in a proper understanding of human sexuality. It's not hostile to anyone. It's presenting them with a vision. But anyway, that particular vision, I'll maybe say a wee bit about that. I want to just jump back to something else. This, our time is the end game. It's an end game of that. And I think that's why we've had the Vatican Council and we've now got this year of faith. Because the year of faith, the end game is if each one of you can go out and it's hand-to-hand combat, can you win back people to the Christian vision or not? So it was foreseen by, as I say, the Pope gives the broad outline in Spes Salvi, but Cardinal Newman, and since he was beatified recently, I wanted to quote him on this. He talked about the infidelity of the future. He saw that this attack on the faith was coming. And in one of his homilies, he said, "It cannot be denied that there is just now threatening the political world such a calamity. There are many influential men who think that things are not indeed ripe as yet for such a measure, but who look forward to the times when whether the one or the other great political party propose to lessen the influence of Catholics and circumscribe their privileges. We shall become more and more objects of distrust to the nation at large. Regarded as members of one extended party in all countries, the enemies, as will be thought, of civil liberty and of national progress. In this way, we may suffer disadvantages which have not weighed upon the Catholic Church since the age of Constantine." Now, for him to have seen it then, it's played out better. It's played out it's better for the other side because of the power we have of the mass media and the power we have of politics and for people to work together internationally. Now, a couple of years ago, Peter Tatchell wrote an article in The Guardian, and he boasted that in 1971, he and others had created the Gay Liberation Front's manifesto. And so that made me interested, and I thought, well, okay, let's have a read at it. And they state in it, so in 1971, they state, "We must destroy the family and the gender system." So if you think same-sex marriage, I know it's passed in England now, if you think that's the end, more has to come. Father will be able to tell us. In French schools just now, they're teaching children that there are six genders, for example. In some states in America, they're teaching children or they're sending gender coaches into schools to let the kids know that they actually can choose their gender. And this is... There's lots of philosophical ways we could examine why it's come to this. But behind it all, we can really tie it in with maybe the earlier vision I spoke of, the earlier vision about what the human person is and the fact that God has imprinted his nature into male and female. And the givenness of male and female and humanity is reflected of God. What better to do than to destroy that? What better to totally and utterly destroy the image that the complementarity of a man and a woman is ordered to cooperating with God to bring a new life into the world? What more damaging spiritual attack could we have than that? And that's what we're living through. So a lot of people, I speak to politicians every day. A lot of them are nice folk. They really are. But they really don't have a clue about this. They are pawns. The culture has taken them in one direction, and the culture, I'm afraid, is symptomatic of a huge spiritual problem. There literally is a demonic attack on humanity, and we're seeing that in everywhere. And a lot of my job has been responding to lots of it, and that's been in abortion. The incessant calls for euthanasia among our politicians and through our media. That has been a huge fight. The fact that now we can manipulate human beings in the womb, destroy embryos at the earliest stages, create chimeras. A chimera is a mixture of an animal and a human being, creating the monsters of Greek mythology in labs in the United Kingdom. That's the sort of stuff we're allowed to do now. This is a spiritual battle, and it needs a spiritual response. And the only institution capable of doing it is the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church can only reach out into all those avenues if you're out there doing it. The priests and the bishops can't reach there. And that's why we have this year of faith. This is sending every one of us out to carry the message of the truth of the vision, the noble vision of the human person. And that's what we're all called to. And that's really, I suppose, for me to finish off, is what I'm urging you to do. A lot of the work, to be honest, I don't have much to show for fighting all of these issues. We had some successes on euthanasia, which was a massive effort. And we did that because we worked very effectively with groups of people. We coordinated our efforts and we convinced the politicians they had to answer to us. And we convinced them that more of our people were willing to go into the parliament and hold them to account than the supporters of euthanasia. And even the week or so before the final debate in the Scottish Parliament on euthanasia, the opinion polls were showing 85% of the public were in favour of it. Now, I know you can ask a particular question to get to change the answers. That's true. 85%, I think maybe you'd get 70% if you asked them more. It's really bad what the general population, but they don't believe about it enough to go out and campaign for it as the proponents of redefining marriage have. They really are zealous, and that's why they've been effective. We've not been as zealous as them. But in euthanasia, so that could come, euthanasia as well. So we're seeing a huge... But it was the lesson I learned from that is if we work together, if we got people... And one MSP stood up during the debate and said to Margot MacDonald, who was MSP, was pushing, she said, Margot, I've read all this stuff, and you keep saying this about so many people support it, but 10 times as many people against euthanasia came to see me in my surgery. Now, thankfully, we had organised people to do that. So, but her experience was that there were people willing to give her a hard time. We need to do it in all the issues, and we need to save our fellow human beings from destroying the society that we're living in. So that's the challenge for you. I am so glad that an event like this happens, that you get catechetics where you can learn the truth about the faith. If you want, get in touch with my office. You know, we've got a Facebook, RC Politics. I've got leaflets. I'll bring them back for the question time. I've got leaflets for you all to get, and you need to read social teaching, but it's a two-minute introduction to Catholic social teaching. You can just quickly look at it, and it's an aid memoir, keep it in your pocket. And get in touch with my office, or you've got loads of people here can provide you with information. But if you do that, you are joining the winning side. So remember that. It looks bad so often, but we are the winning side. And I'm just going to finish with a quote from someone who was anti-Catholic, who wrote this about 170 years ago. Lord Macaulay, he said, "There is not, and there never was in this earth, a work of human policy so well deserving of examination as the Roman Catholic Church. The proudest royal houses are but of yesterday when compared with the line of supreme pontiffs. The papacy remains not in decay, not a mere antique, but full of life and youthful vigour. The Catholic Church is still sending forth to the farthest ends of the world missionaries as zealous as those who landed in Kent with Augustine, and still confronting hostile kings with the same spirit with which she confronted Attila. The number of her children is greater than in any former age. Nor do we see any sign which indicates that the term of her long dominion is approaching. She saw the commencement of all the governments and of all the ecclesiastical establishment that now exist in the world. And we feel no assurance that she is not destined to see the end of them all. She was great and respected before the Saxon had set foot in Britain, before the Frank had passed the Rhine, when Grecian eloquence still flourished at Antioch, when idols were still worshipped in the Temple of Mecca, and she may still exist in undiminished vigour when some traveller from New Zealand shall, in the midst of a vast solitude, take his stand in a broken arch of London Bridge to sketch the ruin of St Paul's." The Catholic faith. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, John, for being so generous with your insights. We're going to have a quick buzz, just 3 minutes to talk to the people around you and form some questions that John's going to answer for us. It's about 3 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah,
I kept my brain was having to work in parallel to get back to my stories up there.
Did you do a lot of planning, or do you tend to give your account a lot?
No, that was very different. I spent ages.